Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. Well, certainly over the past couple of years, as the price of oil has continued to go up, and increasingly people are concerned about whether we're going to run out of oil, growing numbers of people are starting to look to alcohol as an alternative. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who has been thinking about this and working in this area for now a long time, decades, in fact. Our guest for the program is David Bloom. He first got into this kind of thing back, oh, I don't know, how many years ago? 30 years ago? Back in the 70s. He, when the energy crisis of 78, 79 struck, he started something called the American Homegrown Fuel Company. That's an educational organization that taught a lot of people how to produce and use low-cost alcohol fuel at home or on the farm. Himself, his background is in ecology, biology. He majored in ecological biology and biosystematics at San Francisco State University. He's also been involved in sustainable agriculture for a long time. He is now executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture, which he founded back in 1993, where they teach things like permaculture, which is an approach to ecological land design that takes into account things like agriculture, but also energy and architecture and economics and so forth. So this is the kind of thing he's been doing for a long time. He is also the author of a book that is intended both to address alcohol as an energy and environmental issue, and also as a practical how-to kind of manual that shows people how to do it on a relatively small scale. And it's not the kind of thing that you necessarily have to have an enormous plant to do. In fact, as we'll discuss, it might even be better as a small scale kind of thing. And his book, the title of his book is Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And it's published by the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture based in Santa Cruz in California. So I'm sure that you can find it down at the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. And it has a lot of basic useful information that you might find fascinating. So, alcohol can be a gas. And here on the program, questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, I'm glad to be here, David.
So how was it that you – the thing is, I suppose the context you have to put this in is that the idea of alcohol as an alternative to gasoline is not a new idea at all. Certainly, if you go back to the early days of the automobile in the United States, for example, back then, you had people saying, oil is finite, it's not renewable, we may well have a problem meeting the need for gasoline in the future if we have a lot of cars. Even then, in the early 1900s, people were saying, well, it would really make more sense to run our cars on alcohol than it would be on gasoline. So it's not a new idea at all.
Well, no, actually, it's not. Not only is it not a new idea, it turns out that gasoline was the alternative fuel because, you know, when the first internal combustion engines were built back in the 1800s, it wasn't like there was gasoline lying around that somebody was looking for a use for. You know, the engine came first and fuels came later, and alcohol was the first automobile fuel long before gasoline was invented. Most of the world didn't have oil yet, and there were no tanker lanes to deliver oil to the rest of the world. So even in the United States, most cars ran on alcohol. Gasoline came along later. It was the garbage byproduct of the oil industry. Basically, oil was trying to displace alcohol as the primary lighting fuel of the day because people had oil lamps or alcohol lamps to light their homes and farms. And so Rockefeller used to heat up oil and basically distill off the volatile stuff nobody wanted and got kerosene, which he could sell for lighting and that kind of thing. Well, at night, he'd flush all that volatile stuff into rivers to get rid of it because nobody would buy it. Eventually, he figured out that if you tinkered around with the internal combustion engine, it would run on that volatile toxic waste. And since it was selling for nothing beforehand, he was able to sell it in cities for less than alcohol was selling for. So gasoline started out as an urban method of disposing of oil company toxic waste. But if you went out in the country to get home, you had to stop by a farm and tank up on alcohol. And virtually every farm made their own because it was a very useful substance to have on the farm.
And so what it is that you're here arguing, and what the part of what this book is all about, is that it makes sense, it is feasible, it is doable for various kinds of people to go back to this point, particularly for farmers, and I suppose it depends a lot on what kind of feedstock you have access to, but for farmers to make their own alcohol, perhaps to form alcohol co-ops, and even people in urban settings to make their own?
Certainly. When I first started doing this back in the 80s, I made alcohol from donuts, you know. Donuts, well, cops can only eat so many, and then they have to throw the rest away, you know. So I used to leave drums at the local donut shop, and the first time I did it, I said, well, you call me when they're full, and I'll come back and get them. And they called me the next day and said, come and get them, and my pickup truck was full of donuts, and my first batch, I made 100 gallons of alcohol from one pickup truck full of donuts, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, basically alcohol can be made from, right now, anything with starch or sugar in it. Well, of course, donuts have 10 extra teaspoons of sugar per donut. That's pretty good for making alcohol. And, of course, the donut itself is made of nothing but white flour. Now, flour or starch is pretty much sugars that have been linked together by the plant. So 35 sugars linked together make starch. And we dissolve those with enzymes, the same kind of enzymes you'd find, say, in barley malt. And we can dissolve the starch to sugar, feed it to yeast. The yeast eat the sugar. They breathe out CO2 with some of the sugar, and they also excrete the alcohol. So basically alcohol is, well, yeast poop. And when it gets up to about 13% alcohol, the same percentage you'll see on that bottle of wine that you just last looked at, the yeast keel over from too much drunken partying there in the batch. And we then have to distill the alcohol out using a distillery to, you know, make it pure enough to run cars. And that's the basic process. And we can use all kinds of things in that process to make fuel.
So one of the concerns I think people have about ethanol on a large scale is it does have to do with what the feedstock is that we are using, and the fact that if, for example, we're going to use corn, which seems to be one of the, at least here, I think, in the United States. Now, in other countries, they use different things. But here, basically, we're using corn. The concern there is, well, that's something that we would otherwise use for food. And does it make sense to grow a potential food crop to turn into something that we would put in the tanks of our cars?
Right. Of course, that would be immoral. You know, feeding our SUVs instead of the starving hordes of Africa. And, you know, wouldn't a progressive person feel, you know, a bit embarrassed to be putting alcohol in your car? And the oil companies have been playing this tune pretty heavily for the last 6 or 8 months. So what are the facts? Well, first of all, you know, the reason why we're using corn for alcohol is we have a surplus of corn, you know, huge amount of corn. It's not the best crop for if we were deciding how to produce alcohol for our nation. It only yields about 250 gallons an acre, where other crops like, say, sugar beets or sweet sorghum can yield well over 1,000 gallons. And things we wouldn't even think of as crops, like mesquite pods from the mesquite trees that grow all over as weeds in the Southwest, yield more per acre than corn does. So we have a lot of choices about how we can make alcohol, and we can talk more about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't eat corn in the United States as human beings, and we don't export it to people who eat it as well. Corn is basically animal feed. Now, you know, you look at the uses of corn that people have, and about 1% of it goes into breakfast cereal and tortillas and corn chips. And then really you start looking at parts of corn. In other words, we take some of the corn starch, about 5% of all the corn starch, not the whole corn, and we make high fructose corn syrup. Now, I would argue that that's not food. Now, you might not agree with me, but I don't think that's really important to human nutrition. And then 3% of the corn starch becomes modified food starch, which is another industrial product used to thicken sauce, whatever. So we're still not up to anything that's essential food yet. 1% of it does become whiskey, which I would argue is food, but you might disagree with that. So really, you know, the human use of corn is pretty minimal, and animal feed is what it's all about. So now that we know it's animal feed, why do we feed corn to cattle, et cetera? Well, it's for the protein and fat. You know, cattle are very good at getting energy out of, you know, just plant matter. In other words, hay or any kind of cellulosic thing. They don't need and don't really want starch, which is what mostly what corn is. In fact, cattle can't digest starch very well at all. And one of the reasons why it takes 10 pounds of corn to make 1 pound of beef is most of that starch goes out poorly digested out into the manure. Now, when we make alcohol, we take the starch out first, and then we still have the protein and fat left over to feed the animals. So when you hear pundits say, and we diverted the corn crop to make alcohol, it's not true. We only diverted the starch to make alcohol. The byproduct, dried distillers grains, is an excellent animal feed. In fact, the way the revenuers used to figure out who was moonshining in a county is they'd show up and see who had the fattest hogs on county fair day, and they'd show up that guy's farm the next day and bust him for having it still because they knew he was feeding those animals mash left over from alcohol production.
Mm-hmm. Well, just leaving aside that issue of corn and the impact of ethanol on the food supply or the price of food or so forth, if that was something that you were concerned about, it is – there are a range of things that you could use for your feedstock, and it sounds as if there are some things that you could use to make alcohol that really aren't good for almost anything else.
Well, sure.
That you could, if that was your concern, then you could find things that would otherwise not have value, or perhaps also, are there things that would otherwise be thrown away, like your old donuts that you could also use as feedstock?
Well, of course, there's all kinds of waste products that we can use to make alcohol. But, here we are in the Midwest. And when I was at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair this last summer, I drove from Chicago up to Wisconsin, and I passed 250 miles of cattails growing in the drainage ditches by the side of the road. Now, cattails are a really interesting potential energy crop. You know, they're not, a food crop. They grow in places where we can't really grow food, in other words, where the ground's too wet. And cattails are 60% starch. You know, corn is only 75% starch, but the starch in cattails is the whole stalk itself, 60% of that. So instead of 250 gallons an acre, which we would get from corn, wild cattails would give us maybe 2,500 gallons per acre. But in 500 places in the United States, we now have sewage treatment plants that use cattails as the final stage in sewage treatment to pull the nutrients out of the water before they discharge into rivers or the ocean. Under those circumstances, we actually get yields of 7,500 gallons per acre. And if you start including the cellulose potential, which is now becoming practical, it can be as high as 12,000 gallons an acre. So if we started processing all the sewage or most of the sewage in the United States to a better quality discharge than we do now using cattail marshes, we could supply the whole country with alcohol just from cattails on less than 2% of what would be considered farmland in the United States. So, you know, when we start looking at some of these gifts of nature, like cattails that can provide us with fermentable good stuff, the future is pretty bright indeed. Where I live on coastal areas, one of the things that I have been promoting quite a bit is something that most Norwegian fishermen know, which is you can make whiskey from kelp. Kelp, the ocean plant that grows off our, colder coastal waters. And there's other ones that grow in warmer water. So the American Gas Association took a look at kelp off of California and said, well, if we set up Chinese-style kelp farms, which are floating nets that we grow the kelp on, and the kelp grows like 18 inches a day, you can actually cut that kelp once a week and it just keeps growing. Well, they figured that we could replace about two-thirds of the gasoline we use in the country just from the California coast's artificial kelp farms if we put those in. So you can't, you wouldn't think of the American Gas Association as a bunch of tree-hugging environmentalists. These guys are, dollars and cents, energy people, and they see it as really a way of doing it. And here we are not planting a single seed on soil and replacing most of the fuel in the United States. Now, down there in the Mississippi, where all the sewage and all the fertilizer drains from between the Rockies to the Appalachians down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico, we got over 20,000 square kilometers of ocean, of Gulf, that are considered the dead zone every year, where that fertilizer causes microscopic algae to bloom and then die and rot. And when it does so, it uses up all the oxygen. So in that whole area, there's nothing alive for most of the year. If we went ahead and established algae farms there in the ocean, we could actually oxygenate the water because caliper plants, they would breathe in the carbon dioxide in the water, breathe out oxygen, saving all that sea life and the shrimp industry, and we could supply most of the country with alcohol right there from the Gulf. The kelp solution left over, well, now that we don't need the oil pipelines from those oil platforms out in the Gulf, could be used to move the kelp solution to the Midwest, and that would replace almost all of our fertilizer, which comes from natural gas. So, you know, when you start, you know, getting serious about, okay, how do we produce alcohol in a way that is environmentally sound? We have many choices, and these are just two of the ones that I talk about in the book. Both are practical. Both are cost-effective today. Both are being done for other purposes, like cattails on sewage treatment plants and Chinese kelp farms. So it's, we don't need a new technological breakthrough. We just need to apply what we already know.
Well, I got some callers here I want to get right to. But then I suppose this really begs the question, if this is so promising and we obviously we need the energy and we're concerned about the cost of oil, and we're concerned about the supply, and something we're talking about all the time from the president all the way down. So if we have this great solution at hand, why aren't we doing it? Why aren't we doing it now? Why now don't we have huge kelp farms off the coast of California producing alcohol?
Well, you got to realize that the awareness of peak oil and the price of oil going up has only been in the last few years. So it takes a while for anything to get off the ground. And it's taken a long time for people to begin to realize that we really have a problem here. I think this last couple of weeks with oil reaching pretty much $90 a barrel has started to set a few more people to thinking. You got an industry, the oil industry, that for 100 years has been fighting alcohol with misinformation and dividing those who support it, you know, in ways that have really affected the politics around this. And that's what we're talking about. I'll give you a quick example. And before we take questions here, you know, early on in the 1900s, alcohol and gasoline were neck and neck. And the farmers and Henry Ford were very much in favor of alcohol fuel. Henry Ford used to say, if we can't be the farmer's customer, how can he be ours? And he understood the ecology of commerce. Well, Rockefeller didn't care about that. He was tired of having to compete with a bunch of farmers for the fuel market. So he went out and found an interesting group called the Women's Christian Temperance Movement. He funded them to the tune of $4 million, which would be like $80 million today. So you got to realize Congress back then in the early teens was all male, women couldn't vote yet, and hard drinking. And those guys voted for a constitutional amendment banning the production of alcohol. They were well paid off. And basically, prohibition was enacted and took alcohol off the market for more than a dozen years. And then gasoline became our national fuel. That's the kind of bare-knuckle, hardball battle that's been going on between oil and alcohol from the very start. And there are legions of dirty tricks that the oil companies have performed over time on the alcohol industry. So the food versus fuel argument today, the blaming alcohol for the increase in the price of food, these are all American Petroleum Institute propaganda pieces that don't have any basis in fact.
If you're interested in learning more about alcohol as fuel, and particularly the very practical questions involved in making it, how exactly you do it, you can look at this book that I mentioned right at the beginning of the program by our guest David Bloom. The title of the book is Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and it is intended to be a practical manual, instruction manual, among other things, for people who would say, well, can I do that? And he would say, yes, actually, you can, and it would show you how. So that's one thing that you can do. Look for the book, and the lines are full, so why don't we talk with some of the people who are listening. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll start in with someone in Urbana on our line one right here. Hello. So caller there, line one. Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
The question is how far the prices of gasoline have to go up to make alcohol a subsidy-free fuel. I'm not sure if there is a clear-cut answer to that.
Yes, there is.
Given the subsidies that agriculture gets, and the subsidies that the ethanol itself gets. And on top of that, the complications that the alcohol industry says that even the gasoline production is subsidized to some extent. So how do we sort this out, and how do we determine when alcohol can stand on itself? I'll end up and listen. Thank you.
Right. Well, I addressed that very thoroughly in the book, so let me give you the high points. First of all, the oil companies are fond of railing about alcohol's subsidies. And first of all, when it comes to agriculture, every country subsidizes its agriculture because, you know, we're all pretty addicted to food. So it's important for us to make sure that we provide enough food. And so that requires most countries to make sure its agriculture is buffered from some of the free market. But let's talk about the subsidies for energy. Alcohol gets approximately 61 cents a gallon tax credits that are the composite of two credits. One is a 51 cent a gallon excise tax credit, and the other is a producer's credit. Oil companies, on the other hand, according to the Center for Technology Assessment, gets $5.60 a gallon tax credits when you add everything up. And I think that's a very conservative number. The actual drain on our treasury and our tax base is actually larger than that. That figure comes before we talk about the war in Iraq, which, of course, you can look at as one giant subsidy for oil. So alcohol already can stand on its own 2 feet without subsidies if the oil companies don't get theirs. In fact, alcohol is currently, under the current subsidized environment, the oil companies getting 10 times the subsidies of alcohol. Alcohol is still competitive with oil at $40 a barrel. We can produce alcohol commercially in the United States for a little over a dollar a gallon, and there's no way we can do that anymore with $60, $70, $80 a barrel oil. So it's already competitive with oil.
All right. Let's go to the next caller, and this would be in Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm not at all advocating oil, but I am advocating that we need to even go away from ethanol. Ethanol also releases carbon into the atmosphere, and the carbon into the atmosphere is really the true problem we're facing today. We need to move into hydrogen, and the only way we can move to hydrogen efficiently anymore is to go through nuclear and then go into another power source would be much better, whatever that may be.
All right, so I can answer that for you, because what you're hearing is the oil company line about CO2 and ethanol. And they'll often say that both gasoline and ethanol put 20 pounds of CO2 into the atmosphere with each gallon of fuel that's burned. So that's fine. That's true. But unlike oil, the plants get their CO2 from the air. In other words, when corn grows, it takes in carbon dioxide, water, and sunlight via photosynthesis and makes carbohydrates. Now, the carbo part of carbohydrates is carbon dioxide. The hydrate is water. When we In a simple description, the amount of carbon dioxide we release from the car is the same amount we need to grow next year's crop. So the net amount of carbon dioxide released is essentially zero. The more complicated answer, which is where we need to go in the future, is that when we grow crops for energy, especially crops in a polyculture, the way we talk about in my book and in permaculture, where we grow more than one crop together. December 8th, Science Magazine last year published a wonderful study that showed that because of the way plants grow, the sugar that they produce by photosynthesis largely goes to feeding underground microorganisms that are necessary to the life of the plant. And in this case, when you look at the whole plant cycle, not just the corn, but the whole corn plant, the amount of CO2 that's sequestered is 13 times what is released when we make the alcohol and when we burn it. So basically, if we want to reverse global warming, we need to increase photosynthesis. Now, my feelings about nuclear power is that if you're really talking about avoiding subsidies, like one of the earlier callers said, you really have to stay away from nuclear power. But the other problem with nuclear power is the plant lasts for maybe 40 years before it's, you know, basically unfit to use. And then we've got, you know, 4.5 billion years of dangerous substances we have to store, which is pretty much as long as the sun will be burning in our solar system. So it's a bad investment to go ahead and start using nuclear power when we had, you know, cannot possibly afford to store the waste for any length of time.
Sir, I would like to point out that by going to hydrogen, which is the point of my question is going to hydrogen. Hydrogen produces no carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide today, sir, in 1970, these were excellent ideas. We're beyond that. Our
hydrogen is not an energy source.
Now.
It's an energy carrier. So when you make hydrogen, the way you would make it is with coal or nuclear power. Now, you can claim that nuclear power is carbon-free, but recent studies in Australia show that the amount of carbon dioxide used in the construction of all that cement and steel for a nuclear power plant does not equal the carbon dioxide emission-free characteristics of it for 40 years. By then, the plant is basically garbage. So it's not true that nuclear is carbon-free. It just is embodied in the building and construction of it. Hydrogen itself is not found anywhere on the planet. You got to make it with some other form of energy. And when you use coal or natural gas or you use nuclear to produce the electricity to electrolyze and make hydrogen, you are producing huge amounts of carbon dioxide from fossil fuels, or in the case of fossil fuels used to make the concrete for a nuclear reactor. So hydrogen is a shell game that basically does not reduce global warming.
Sir, we still have to realize that every gallon of anything we burn in carbon puts it into the atmosphere. We've got to stop that. That's what we have to stop.
Right, and
thank you very much.
Growing crops for alcohol does just that.
All right, well, let's go on here to Charleston next, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I have heard in so far the subject matter that alcohol will have some reaction upon the ozone, and the internal combustion engine has a viable energy source. We cannot take that to infinity. Somewhere, all that has to stop, and we have to get modes of transportation that are going to, and you just said about building the nuclear power plant, all the energy it takes to build one automobile and then to power that thing and to do that until it wears out, and the production of that keeps moving forward and even to the used car where people continue to use it as absolute junk again, then it is melted down again, which is better than boiling rocks. But still, how is the, and if I understand too, the alcohol burns hotter than gasoline, and that there is some gasoline in ethanol. Is that right?
Let me go ahead, and you've got about three questions there, and I can answer all of them. The ozone study you refer to is by Mark Jacobson at Stanford. That study was performed under what we in California call the Global Warming is Good for You grant, which is the $100 million that Exxon gave to Stanford to study global warming. It turned out that that study, which was highly publicized, basically said that, and this was a computer model, not based on any actual testing, that the slight emissions of alcohol leaking through the hoses on your fuel system, and this is a pretty tiny amount of alcohol to escape as a vapor through the hose, would go through changes in the atmosphere, which would eventually become ozone, and that might cause as many as 200 excess deaths in L.A. Basin from this theoretical reaction. But what wasn't calculated in the study is the 14,000 deaths that occur in L.A. every year right now from benzene, xylene, and toluene, which are carcinogens that are part of gasoline. So even if the study was true, the net result would be many tens of thousands of people over time saved by not breathing in these carcinogens. Now, it turned out that after the study came out, the EPA did the math and found out the model was incorrect. And actually, the reverse was true, that even under the model created by Jacobson, more lives would be saved in the ozone department as well. That turned out to be well-publicized propaganda that was untrue. In terms of alcohol burning hotter than gasoline, nothing could be further from the truth. Alcohol, because more of the fuel becomes work, it burns more efficiently than gasoline, produces less waste heat. So the combustion temperature of alcohol in your engine, instead of being about 1350 Fahrenheit, which is what gasoline is, only about 1,100 with alcohol. I'll give you a quick story. Back, I used to have an old 52 Chevy fire truck I used to run on alcohol back in the 80s. And back then we had fan belts, you know, which took 17 horsepower to run the engine cooling fan. Well, when I was running on alcohol, I took the engine fan completely off the car and threw it away because the engine burned so cool, just water running through the radiator was enough to cool the engine without the additional horsepower to blow air over it. So alcohol is a much cooler burning fuel than gasoline. In fact, because alcohol produces no carbon in the engine and burns cooler, in Brazil over the last 20 years, we've got very good data to show that alcohol triples engine life over gasoline.
All right, and the future of the internal combustion engine, then, is very rosy. And we can have an internal combustion engine and logically have no pollution, and we have this largesse from
Well, I agree with you that conservation is the most important thing we can do, and mass transit is equally important. But that mass transit system's got to be powered by something, and it would probably be better to be doing that with alcohol than it would be with gasoline. Now, you brought up pollution there because I brought it up. Alcohol is close to 98% pollution-free compared to gasoline. Now, I sometimes say it's 105% cleaner because I'll give you an example. I worked with Gordon Cooper, the astronaut and aerospace engineer back in the 80s, certifying a jet engine for alcohol. And, well, you know, we rolled in this great big machine that we got one day, which was the forerunner of the modern smog testing machine that would test the exhaust gases. And we were thrilled with our new toy, and we stuck the probe up the exhaust of the jet engine running there on the test stand, and nothing happened. None of the needles were moving. And we thought, well, heck, this thing is brand new, and it doesn't work. And we're banging the probe on the table, and nothing works. And so finally I set the probe down as we were going to lunch in front of the jet engine, and all the needles started to move. The L.A. air going into the jet engine running on alcohol was dirtier than the exhaust coming out.
Well, it just sounds, that old saw, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably isn't.
Well, you know, there are negatives with alcohol. And, you know, so let's go ahead and talk about those. First of all, alcohol is not as volatile as gasoline. In other words, you know, some people will say, oh, my God, alcohol is so flammable, so explosive. But when's the last time you were in a bar and somebody had a 1,200-degree cigarette a couple of inches away from a vodka dry martini and you saw the bar explode? That just doesn't happen. So basically, when it comes to starting your car, that lack of volatility is a detriment. In Brazil, they use the kind of cold start device. By the way, Brazil, 50% of the cars run on pure alcohol there. Compared to the rest of them running on 25% alcohol mixed with gasoline. So they have a huge amount of experience there. I was at the GM plant in Brazil, and what they have under the hood is a little thing that looks like a windshield wiper reservoir, and it goes to a little tiny fuel pump to a line that squirts into the air supply of the engine. And when you turn the key, if it's a cold day, that little pump pumps a little fluid from the reservoir, squirts it into the air supply of the engine so it's able to start the car with something more volatile, and then it runs fine on alcohol. So, you know, up here where it gets cold in the winter, this is going to be important. Well, what was it in the reservoir? Half alcohol, half gasoline. People every 6 months or so in Brazil throw open the hood. They go ahead just like filling their windshield wiper reservoir. They just go to the pump, put a few ounces of gasoline in the thing, put a few ounces of alcohol, and that's their starting solution. You know, so that is a disadvantage. You have to do a little bit less convenient, you know, automatic driving. You have to every so often fill up your reservoir. Alcohol will also get a little less mileage than gasoline while we're talking about negatives. You know, the modern internal combustion engine is designed around optimization for gasoline, which means basically dumbing it down to the low octane of gasoline. Alcohol is 105 octane. Gasoline, of course, is roughly 87. So you can't take full advantage of the high octane of alcohol with your modern car. And so you'll lose 10, 12% miles per gallon if you were to go ahead and start using alcohol, doing an inexpensive conversion to your car. But if you do take advantage of alcohol's high octane, as the EPA did in a study did in 1998, they found that they could get 22% better mileage than diesel in a Volkswagen TDI engine converted to alcohol. Now, of course, diesel gets better mileage than gasoline. So if we design engines to optimize for alcohol, we can actually get considerably better mileage. And there you go. You know, you're talking about what we do for the future. If cars are getting 22% better mileage with smaller high compression engines, we're using less materials to build the car and we're using less fuel overall.
We have some more callers here, and time is moving along pretty rapidly here. We got about 15 minutes left. Just very quickly, now all the gasoline in the United States has 10% ethanol in it.
No, it varies from state to state. In California, we have 5.7%. Minnesota,
maybe I'm thinking here in the state of Illinois, maybe it's all.
I'm sure it's all at least 10% here, but you also sell 85%
right.
at the pump.
Get the E85, mm-hmm. which is 85% ethanol, and there are vehicles that are designed to use that.
But your car will use it too.
Well, see, now that's that. Here, there's a. I'm sure that my the folks at Volkswagen who made my car would say, Dave, don't put that in your car.
Well, they might not warranty you to do that, but basically every car on the road today that runs with fuel injection, and that's pretty much every car since the mid-1980s, will run at least 50% alcohol without any changes whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And this is something the public just doesn't have any idea about, the kind of thing we discuss in our book and at the workshop we've got coming up. All over the Midwest right now, people are looking at the lower price for alcohol and gasoline saying, why don't you put a little of that in my tank as well as the gasoline? And people are mixing and finding out that it's absolutely true that 50-50 runs great in almost every car. Now, above 50%, some cars' computers don't have enough brains to make the adjustment between alcohol and gas because alcohol needs less air than gasoline. And some cars do. So some cars will run E85 without any modification. Ford, Toyota Priuses, for example, do that quite well. And many other cars do as well, but we don't have a full list yet of the ones that don't need any modification that have smart enough computers. But it's very simple to go ahead and throw in a Brazilian-style kit, which allows you to flip a switch and go between alcohol and gasoline. So you can use E85, or you can use gasoline, or any mixture in between. So it's not true that our cars won't run on alcohol. You can go ahead and start doing it today by running 50-50. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of the disadvantages of when you do that is that all the crud that has deposited on the inside of your gas tank from bad batches of gas will be dissolved by alcohol, will wash off and plug your fuel filter if you do this cold turkey. So if you're going to do this experiment at home, what you want to do is, this tank of gas, put in 1 gallon of E85. The next tank of gas, use 2 gallons and work your way up to 50%. And when you do that, it washes the inside of the tank slowly, doesn't plug up your filter, and all that varnish and tar just burns in the engine until it's all gone. So, you know, if you want to avoid having to change your fuel filter, ease in to using E85, and you should be able to use at least 50%.
Yeah, and your argument is that either by designing them differently or by altering them, the things that we have now that use gasoline, cars, trucks, buses, lawnmowers, airplanes, could all run on alcohol.
We have chapters for all those in the book on how to convert each one of those. In particular, things like lawnmowers, et cetera, are just adjustments. You know, there's really not much in the way of any kind of conversional equipment needed. When it comes to chainsaws, all we need to use is a different two-stroke lubricant than we use because normal ones don't mix with alcohol. So there are special alcohol-based two-stroke lubricants we can mix. My chainsaw runs on alcohol, and it's kind of annoying because the spark plug never fouls, and I don't get to take a break, you know, to clean it, you know. So...
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Bloom. He is the executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture. And by the way, if you're interested in finding out about them, they have a website. It's www.permaculture. That's all one word, permaculture.com. So you can find out about them, where you can also get more information about his book that we have mentioned here. And the title is Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and it's about the use of alcohol as an alternative to gasoline, and also about not only how you can use it, but how you can make it.
Well, and also how you can bring it to your community. You know, part of the book is about how we can take control back of our energy supply by starting our own stations. So I'm in the process in the next 3 months of opening the first station in California, and it will be a driver-owned alcohol station. So the reason why we're doing it this way is those tax credits we talked about earlier. Well, normally you don't get to pass those through to the driver. Only business owners in the fuel business can take that credit, including the retailer of the fuel. So what we intend to do, because each one of our driver owners will be both an owner and a customer of the station, that we will be able to pass the 61 cent a gallon tax credit through to the drivers, you know, who are members of the station, rather than the oil companies getting those tax credits when they blend alcohol with gasoline. You know, we get the same credits they do. So our station will probably sell alcohol for somewhere around $2.50 a gallon, but then people will get 61 cent rebate 3 months later. So it'll be well below $2. And we cut the oil companies completely out of the picture in doing this kind of thing. Once the station is up and running, we will contract with local farmers to produce the fuel for the station. But right now, we'll buy the alcohol from Midwest farm cooperatives. Half the alcohol plants in the United States are farmer-owned, and I would much rather give a farmer my money than some oil company.
All right, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go next to line three and someone in Urbana. Hello.
One thing I haven't heard addressed yet is the matter of the amount of water needed for production of alcohol. And recently there's been a lot of concern about the fact that the world may be in very shortly in greater need of fresh water than oil. I mean,
that's already true.
Yeah.
I mean, something like 70 countries in the world right now import water. And in fact, oil tankers make more money transporting water back from the United States than they do transporting the oil here. They get more money for the water. So it's already an issue. Now, this is a really good question because it brings up the question of scale. Really large alcohol plants don't have a way of returning the water back to the environment where it came from because they're too divorced. They're too geographically far from where the corn came from. In a smaller plant, instead of a 100 million gallon per year plant, what if you're only looking at 1 to 5 million gallons per year? Well, now that plant can be in the center of a collection of farms immediately adjacent to it. So at the end of the alcohol making process, after we've distilled the alcohol out of the mash, we have this liquid left over. In the big plants, they evaporate the water away because they can't discharge it anywhere. You know, that would be a big issue for regulation. So they evaporate the water off using a lot of energy so that the remaining syrup that's left over can be added to the animal feed. But if we had if we're doing this with a smaller plant, well, then we just take the liquid left over and we'd use it as irrigation water on our farms, and it's full of the nutrients that were left over from the corn. So we're returning that back to the soil, avoiding the use of chemical fertilizer. This is a really sterling example of why smaller scale alcohol makes more sense than big, super big industrial alcohol. And in fact, almost all the objections that people have to ethanol today are really objections to the current scale it's done at. As Barry Commoner, the famous ecologist, used to say about alcohol, it's always possible to do a good thing stupidly. And, you know, going past a certain scale with alcohol fits that category. Because alcohol is liquid solar energy and solar energy is decentralized, our plants should be decentralized as well.
One thing in Champaign County, much of our water comes from an aquifer that is really fossil water, and tapping that is going to be a problem. It's also with a proposed alcohol plant in Champaign County. There's been a lot of concern about that.
Well, you know, if they ask me to consult on this, I can show them how to infiltrate more water back into the soil that will eventually reach aquifer levels that can be drawn on than actually would be used in the plant. But no one's asked me yet. Now, when it comes to, the use of water in alcohol plants, some of the new plants are now being built that don't have cooling towers. They're recovering the energy and condensing the steam back out and reusing the water. And in those cases, the reduction in alcohol used in the alcohol plant is 90%. Some of the newest plants that are being designed this way. They cost a little more to build this way, but what they're anticipating is that water will go up in price, and it's smarter to recover the water than waste it by evaporating it away or drying it out of the animal feed. So again, it's not necessary to do things stupidly. And in fact, it's more profitable to do things ecologically in the long run.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This is also Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, thank you for this fascinating program. I feel like I've learned a great deal already. I apologize if you didn't address this already, but if you did address this already, I'm sorry. Are there issues that have to do with different types of energy uses. So maybe alcohol is very great at replacing gasoline in people's cars, but that's not all. That's not the only way that we use energy in the United States. And could you speak to that issue about like the electricity grid and the use of oil? You know, all the different uses of petroleum that are embedded in so much else.
Yeah, for instance, out here in the Midwest, you folks heat with fuel oil. Now, you know, and where you don't have natural gas. And fuel oil burners can run on alcohol just fine. It takes basically changing your injector nozzle to the next size up and adding 1% biodiesel to the alcohol to lubricate the fuel oil pump, and alcohol can be used, E85 can be used to run your fuel oil burner, although straight alcohol is even a little better. When it comes to generating electricity, we have a whole chapter in the book about cogeneration, because basically around the world, people are starting to use smaller generators for neighborhoods, businesses, and even homes, because when you do things properly with a cogenerator, you recover all the waste heat that would otherwise be, say, thrown away in a radiator to end up heating all the water for the home and heating the home. So you get electricity and the hot water that you can use for radiant heating or baseboard water heaters, etc. When you do that, your cost of heating and electricity are vanishingly small because you're not wasting any of the fuel. You're getting all the energy out of it. So there are many things we can do. And in much of the world where deforestation is a huge issue, the issue really, if you look at the world problem with deforestation, it isn't logging companies getting timber. It's people cutting down trees for cooking fuel. Well, alcohol can save a family having to walk 6 hours each way to bring home an armload or two of cooking fuel for the week's meals. If the village grew a little cassava or any number of other local energy crops, would provide both employment and would also provide local fuel that people don't have to go cut down trees for. And it's much more efficient than deforesting our land. So alcohol has many more implications beyond running our cars, because, you know, in a lot of the world, cars are not the issue. It's cooking fuel. It's, you know, can you use an alcohol-powered refrigerator to keep the village's medicines cold? You know, I get calls from around the world for these other uses of alcohol, which are as important or more important than running it in cars. But all of it has to do with reducing global warming.
And how about in the United States? Can you give like a rough breakdown of sort of percentages or how can we conceptualize, you know, what could be replaced in terms of oil use beyond the car use?
All of it. Every bit of it. Because almost everything that we currently use, we could replace with alcohol from what we talked about earlier in the show, with, you know, some of these more unusual feedstocks and growing things. For instance, right now, we have 30 million acres of lawn in the United States, and there's only 70 million acres of corn in a typical year. The lawn clippings alone would replace 11% of the oil we use in this country. Mesquite, a tree that grows not on farmland but in the deserts of the Southwest, covers, 70 million acres, the same as the amount of corn. And actually harvesting the sugary pods would equal more than the amount of alcohol we could get from corn. And those trees are already there. They're weeds out there on rangeland. So we have so many ways that we could replace fuel, and we could replace, and I'm not kidding, all the nuclear power and all the coal in this country, as well as what we use for cars, with a fuel that's clean and reverses global warming. It only takes a little bit of national commitment. Let me put it to you this way. It takes about $1 per annual gallon to build an alcohol plant. So 100 million gallon plant, $100 million. We have spent $500 billion in Iraq so far. Well, curiously enough, the world uses 500 billion gallons of fuel a year. So the amount of money we have spent in Iraq so far would have been enough, and we could have done it in the same length of time, just a handful of years, to build enough alcohol plants worldwide to replace all the petroleum fuel we currently use worldwide permanently. Instead, we flushed $500 billion down the drain trying to secure oil in Iraq. So, you know, what are we waiting for? We can afford to do it. It's cheap. It's cheaper than oil. And it's good for the environment. All that's standing between us are a few dinosaur corporations and the people who, in Washington, who curry their favor. So, you know, it's up to us to do this revolution. And luckily, making alcohol is mankind's second oldest profession. We know how to do this. It doesn't take any new GMO this or that. It doesn't take any new patented technology. We basically need to start setting up stills in our community as businesses and start our own, drive our own stations so that we can patronize those businesses. And it's really that simple. And we're already doing it in California and in the Midwest. Farmers have been doing it for 20 years, owning alcohol plants. And unfortunately, their only customer right now, 99% of the alcohol, are the oil companies. It's up to you and I to change that and start putting it in our cars and support those farmers.
Well, I'm sure that there are more questions than we can answer here this morning on the program. And in fact, we're at the end of the time, so we're going to have to stop. But if you were interested in reading more on this subject, look for this book we mentioned. It's titled Alcohol Can Be a Gas by our guest David Bloom. He is executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture, which he founded back in 1993. They have a website if you're interested in finding out more about them. It's www.permaculture.com. P-E-R-M-A-C-U-L-T-U-R-E, all is one word, permaculture.com. You can find out about them. There's information there about the book.
And the workshop this weekend in Chicago. We have an eight-hour workshop for people to be able to learn how to make alcohol, start these stations, convert their vehicles. And I would very much encourage people to come. And we do have a half-price student discount for that. All that information is on our website.
All right, permaculture.com, our guest, David Bloom. And also, you can go down to the bookstore and look for the book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Thank you very much for being here.